Good afternoon. I would like to welcome you all to this last session of the day until the evening session of Sunstone. I'll remind you, first of all, to please turn off your cell phones and other noise-making devices. And if it rings, I'm going to take you out and take you to the woodshed or something like that. This is session number 271, Theocracy Unfounded, What the Polygamy Ruling Means for the Plural Families in Utah. I'm Nadine Hansen. I'll be the moderator today. And we have one change in our panel. Our first speaker is going to be Jennifer Basquiat, and she's a professor of anthropology at the College of Southern Nevada. Has conducted field work in plural communities for the last 4 years. Our second panelist was going to be Joe Darger, but he, I understand, had to go out of town today, so his wife, Vicki, is going to be speaking, and she's a practicing polygamist. Vicki, were you a co-author of the book also?
Yes.
Okay, Vicki also is a co-author of the book, Love Times Three, Our True Story of Polygamous Marriage. Then we have Stan Shep. And Stan is a practicing polygamist and member of the Centennial Park community. And we will conclude and give Polly the last word. And she also is a member of Plural Culture, as well as a Centennial Park Action Committee member devoted to the decriminalization of polygamy. And so I will turn the time over to, let's see, did I say everything I was supposed to say? I told you to turn off your cell phones. Okay, I think we're good, and I will turn the time over to Jennifer.
That sounds almost as bad as my knees these days. My goodness. First of all, thank you so much for coming. I know that oftentimes at the end of the day, it gets a little bit weary. You've been in sessions and panels all day, so we really very much appreciate your attendance. I wanted to talk about this issue for a couple reasons. When I started doing field work with in Centennial Park about 4 years ago, I never thought we'd, in so short of a time, come this far in terms of effectively decriminalizing polygamy. And when I heard of the ruling last December, I was astounded and happy and elated and also perplexed as to what this was going to mean for the community, how people were going to receive it, and ultimately what the lasting impact was going to be. The 11th Article of Faith states that we claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of our own conscience and allow all men the same privilege. Let them worship how, when, or what they may. However, that has not been the case in often laws and legislation that is passed within the state of Utah. That oftentimes legislation or laws passed are very squarely aimed at certain segments of religious belief that mainstream Mormonism finds unsavory or distasteful. What I'd like to talk about just briefly is what the ruling does, what this ruling does not do, and finally, what's the big deal? Why are people so twisted up over something that when you look at it on its face, while doing something quite monumental, really only makes a small tweak. Jonathan Turley, who was the lead counsel in arguing for the decriminalization of polygamy, argued that bigamy in the literal sense, in other words, the fraudulent or otherwise impermissible possession of two purportedly valid marriage licenses for the purpose of entering into more than one purportedly legal marriage, is really the only prohibition and prosecution the state can engage in. What the ruling does is simply strike down the criminalized discussion of cohabitation, religious cohabitation, and the idea or practice of what many refer to as spiritual wives. When this ruling was passed, which struck down this religious cohabitation, was really bring Utah's bigamy laws in line with virtually every other state in the United States. Traditionally, rules for bigamy have centered around the idea of fraud, that you are a bigamist if you are, and as the case most often goes, engaged in two separate marriages without the knowledge or consent of either spouse. So you have those traditional, they've made about a zillion Lifetime movies about this, where the wives don't know of each other and they're separate families in separate states or separate parts of the same town. That's traditionally what people understand bigamy to mean. But in Utah, the bigamy law was squarely aimed right at the fundamentalist Mormon practice of polygamy. Jonathan Turley called this a ruling for privacy, not a ruling for polygamy. So what the ruling does is decriminalize cohabitation. It is the decriminalization of cohabitation. It is no longer a third-degree felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. It has tremendous benefits to plural families. Because of the decriminalization of the Cohabitation Act, the relationships they've chosen to structure their family around are no longer felonies. They are able to engage and participate in contracts that benefit and preserve the sanctity of that family. Because of the ruling, they are now allowed to enact contracts for power of attorney, for medical and legal, property rights, child custody, inheritance, wills, estate planning. Virtually the only thing this ruling does not do is allow for state and federal welfare benefits and legal protections in court proceedings. If this makes sense, if you're just kind of looking at it, it's really about what a family chooses to do in the privacy of its own home. Its private contract can now confer most marriage benefits without an official marriage license. And that is what this effective decriminalization of polygamy has done. It's equally important to talk about what the ruling does not do. The ruling does not legalize polygamy. Multiple marriage licenses cannot and will not be granted, at least not at this point in time. The ruling does not legalize or decriminalize underage marriage. It is still an unlawful practice. What this did determine is that while you may have a right to privacy, you do not have a constitutional right to plural unions. And so polygamy, plural families, decriminalized, but not legally recognized in the sense of traditional marriage. This ruling did not, as some opponents have claimed, rewrite the law. All it did was strike down or sever the religious cohabitation portion that had existed on Utah's bigamy laws for such a long time. And to help you understand, if you didn't, the severity of having cohabitation decriminalized is that before this ruling, it was still a third-degree felony, punishable of up to 5 years in prison. And most of the time, in recent years, this has not been something that the state attorney has decided to go after. The idea was if we were going to prosecute or persecute or both polygamy, it was going to be for abuse, fraud, domestic violence, but polygamy itself wasn't going to be targeted. Many people say, okay, so polygamy's not targeted. What's the big deal? Who cares if it's a felony? They're not prosecuting that. But they could. And there are tremendous stories, heartbreaking stories, that many of my friends have shared with me who have memories of the 1953 raid, or have family stories of families being broken apart and children torn from their homes and without permission attempted to be put up for adoption in other states, of husbands being imprisoned, families torn apart. So just because it doesn't happen, just because it was common practice not to prosecute, it could at any time. And that's a terrible specter of fear to live under. So if the ruling only strikes down the religious cohabitation law, and it doesn't truly legalize polygamy, what's the big deal? People tend to, as I'm sure you know, have a very knee-jerk reaction to polygamy. There are four major arguments that people tend to bring up when talking about polygamy, that it is a great example of religious coercion, that polygamy inherently involves abuse and underage marriage, that polygamy creates tremendous psychological distress, and that if we legalize polygamy, even decriminalize polygamy, that will result in an explosion of polygamous unions. But are these things exclusive to polygamy? I mean, yeah, the explosion of polygamy. I mean, I just have some sort of science fiction version of, you know, polygamy exploding everywhere, which is about as realistic as I'm willing to to think in regard to that. But it does take me back to the idea of perspective, that what is seen as problematic is all in the eye of the beholder. It's something that I tell my students all the time. Those of you that have heard me speak on this issue before have most undoubtedly heard me use this definition, and it's the definition of the word cult. Most of us like to think we understand what a cult is. We have very strong feelings about a cult, and the best definition I've ever heard of a cult is this: the church down the street from yours. Hey, just let that seep in for a minute. Okay, what that gets at is that if it's not your faith, if it's not your story, it's strange and coercive and weird and it shouldn't be trusted. And that's so much at the core of why people have negative reactions to polygamy. I'm certainly not going to get up here and say that all polygamy is fantastic, that all plural marriages and families are shining beacons of success. But no marriage is, monogamous or polygamous, has nothing to do with that. So let's talk about the first one, the idea that polygamy is problematic because it involves religious coercion and or the illusion of consent. What I'd like to point out is that, much like the definition of a cult, what is coercion to one is simply an act of faith to another. Okay, there are many arguments that can be made that an 8-year-old does not have the intellectual capacity to commit to baptizing and entering into a covenant for the rest of his or her life. But why do they choose it? This is a choice that is celebrated. They choose it in part because hopefully they have faith, but they also choose it because they're 8. And suddenly this event is about them, and they get treated special. They have parties. They have people telling them how proud of them they are. You could make an argument, and I'm not making this argument, but you could make an argument that that's coercive, that if you dangle all of these rewards in front of a child, they're going to grasp that. To the outside world, mainstream Mormonism is coercive because it encourages not only a very strict law of chastity, but also young marriage. That we would celebrate a young woman who is 19 choosing to get married in the temple as a shining beacon of success. And that may be, but it may also be that she's succumbing to social pressure and or she just wants to have sex. And these are realities, and they're uncomfortable realities to talk about, and they make people kind of get a little upset. And oftentimes they do that because it's a personal reaction to something that one person thinks is coercive and yet another person thinks is simply God's plan or faith. When it's your religion, it's never really seen as coercive. It's seen as God's plan. But when it's another religion, we say things like, how can a woman choose to marry a man who already has two wives? Okay, it's important to take out of this equation the idea of underage marriage. All of the proponents of polygamy and the people that I know who are engaging in plural marriage are 100% opposed to that. So we're not talking about issues of abuse. That's a separate issue. The second knee-jerk reaction is about abuse and or underage marriage. As was quoted from the ruling, the state presented no evidence that child abuse, domestic violence, and failure to pay child support had higher incidence in polygamous families. Abuse does exist, but it's not inherent. Anytime you have a family structure, you have the possibility for abuse. Ideas like a male head of household, controlled finances, explosive outbursts of violence, women seen as property, are all problems that monogamous marriage has suffered. Do we ban monogamy? Do we say marriage is not helpful? Marriage is not for the good of women or men? No. We make changes to the laws to make sure that those abuses don't occur. And when they do occur, we prosecute them. So I'm not going to say that there's no abuse and there's no underage marriage in polygamy. There is. But you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. Okay, you take a look at what are the real issues here. The real issues are abuse. The real issues are criminal acts. Those should be prosecuted, whether it's a plural marriage or a monogamous marriage. Those are not problems inherent only to polygamy. The third is the idea that polygamy somehow causes psychological distress. Canadian researchers examined, prepare yourself for this shockingly large number, 117 polygamous women and compared them to 235 monogamous women. Now, given that roughly in the United States there are 40,000 practicing polygamists, that's a pretty small sample size, so we should sort of chuck it out just on that. But this research did show that polygamists showed much higher psychological distress, both physical and emotional. They often had physical ailments that they could not trace to an actual physical cause. Children showed mental difficulties and social problems. It was estimated that this is because of neglect. This may or may not be true. I haven't seen it to be true. I haven't seen studies that purport it to be true, not in the numbers they're talking about. But let me raise this question. How psychological distressing is it to you to know that you are a criminal, to know that you are committing a third-degree felony? I would argue that a lot of the supposed psychological distress that comes from being a polygamist or a member of a plural family comes from the fact that you can't share your joy. You can't talk about your family to others. You can't live openly and without fear. That's distressing to anyone, regardless of their marital structure. The idea of neglect is one that comes up a lot with polygamous families. And again, this is a matter of what people are capable of doing. Okay, as a child growing up, I was the oldest of six. Okay, I was not a product of a plural or a polygamous union. My mom and dad just had each other. They had six of us. And there were times where, as the oldest of six, I felt neglected. Now, are we talking CPS neglected? No. We're talking about, oh, mom or dad doesn't have time for me because they're dealing with all the rest of these kids. As now the mother of two, that's my limit. Okay, I'm good. Part of that is that I want to explore other avenues, and part of that is I'm trying to give my kids what I didn't have. In other words, a fully present mother and father. But guess what? That's my experience. There are women that I've met are fully capable of loving and giving everything that those children need, no matter how many children there are. It's why you have sister wives. It's why you have that it takes a village mentality. And we run a real problem trying to limit family structure when we assume that everyone has the same strengths and weaknesses. Some people are adequately equipped, more than adequately equipped, to take care of many children and to make sure those children are loved and appreciated. I don't have that. I have everything that I can give to my two kids, and I don't think I could even have a third. And some people are saying, well, that's nothing, you know. I can handle two like a piece of cake. But for me and what I want to give, that's my personal choice. And if we learn anything about this ruling, it is that idea of personal choice, what people are personally able to accomplish as consenting adults. A former polygamist, unhappy with her life as a polygamist, said that on top of all this psychological distress, you have to smile and pretend that everything's okay, because that's part of the culture too. I have news for polygamists. That's a mainstream Mormon thing too. We smile, we nod, we say it's okay. If any of you have been fortunate enough to see the Book of Mormon musical, turn it off. It's out there, and it's something that is not endemic to plural marriage. And that's the key point of what I'm trying to really thread through everything is, yes, everything that we have in real life, polygamists have too. That doesn't mean you throw the whole thing out because we see a few problems. We all struggle with those same problems. And finally, the last concern is that now with this ruling, we're going to have an explosion of polygamy. Let me ask you this. The ruling was about 7 months ago. How many of you are polygamists? That's pre-existing, Stan. Did any of you hear this ruling and say, finally, I have been waiting for this. Now it's my turn. No. And what's even more remarkable is almost every other state in the United States did not have that religious cohabitation rule. So we could have been having polygamy everywhere for decades. But we didn't. Despite what people are concerned about and despite how they worry, polygamy and a plural lifestyle takes a certain level of commitment, takes a certain level of sacrifice that most of us in our Western society have not been prepared to give. You can call it coercion, or you can be more accepting and call it simply someone living out their faith. And that's what each of us hopes that we can do. There's been no rush to claim a plural lifestyle. I don't see that in the future. I teach anthropology, and I talk about this issue with my students all the time, that worldwide, the most preferred type of marriage is polygamy. It's actually polygyny, which is what we mean when we say polygamy, more than one wife. Polyandry is more than one husband, but that's a whole other panel. But polygyny is the most preferred type of marriage worldwide, but monogamy is the most common. And exactly, your face kind of scrunches up and you're like, what? How can that be? That polygyny is the most preferred, but monogamy is the most common. It takes a tremendous amount, stamina, wealth, resources, commitment, to pull off a plural lifestyle. And even though most cultures prefer polygyny, it's not practical because of how hard it is. And if someone wants to take that challenge on as a tenet of their religious faith, and they aren't asking at this point for separate marriage licenses, they simply want not to be felons, we're remiss not to celebrate when that decision happens. So why do I talk about this? I'm not a Mormon, not anymore. I was for a long time. I'm not a polygamist. Probably not ever, although I'd be lying if I didn't say I really appreciate the allure of a sister wife. There are some days when I could use a sister wife or two at home. I live in Las Vegas. Pretty much anything goes there, so why? Why? Why do I talk about polygamy? Why do I care? I care for the same reason that all of you should care. Albert Einstein said, if I were to remain silent, I'd be guilty of complicity. But I think perhaps best, and I'm sure it's a quotation that you've heard before, is from Desmond Tutu. If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. It shouldn't matter what someone else's religious faith is when we're talking about behavior between consenting adults. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Vicki Darger, as she said, I'm the co-author of the book Love Times 3, Our True Story of a Polygamous Marriage. I am one of three wives. We have 25 children in the family, nine of which are mine. The youngest is 8 months. I was raised in a plural family. I have 39 siblings, and I had three mothers. We were raised among, just in suburban Salt Lake City, not among any in a town where it was, you know, we were isolated or anything like that. We went to public school. That sometimes throws people off. They expect to see something that they can go, oh, I can spot a polygamist a mile away. It's not like that for, there's so many. You cannot spot one. I can't spot one a mile away sometimes. 10 feet away. There are so many more than I even am aware of. I'm hearing about new ones every day. Not because of the ruling, like she said, not that people went out and did it because the law changed, just people that I didn't know. My husband has been in the construction industry. I have a sister wife who now is in outreach for basically reaching out to women, mostly within the culture of plural marriage, that are struggling with either a domestic violence issue or just struggling to make ends meet or whatever it might be, just stress or trauma. And my other sister wife owns her own commercial and residential cleaning business. And I am privileged to stay at home, mom, and I work at home as well. I do some accounting work from home. I've been married for almost 25 years, and it hasn't been, you know, I'll tell you, it hasn't been wedded bliss every single minute, but there have been moments of that and plenty of them. And I love my sister wives, and I love my husband, and I love every one of the children, and sometimes I do feel spread a little too thin, like maybe I'm not going to be able to give them all the attention that they need. But I'll tell you what, with my ninth baby, I can't imagine loving her any less, maybe even more than some of my teenagers right now. So, but we're completely devoted to our family and teaching them good values and and things like that, so they can be members of society just along with anyone else. Now, you all know it's hard enough to raise a family, just to make ends meet and to deal with all the emotional things and traumas and dramas and everything that comes up. And then we have this added pressure of this lifestyle that we have to go out and just face people. And you don't know how people are going to react. And we've had some that have been very negative and some that have been, you know, wonderfully positive. When I was in elementary school, my siblings from my other mother, we went to school together, but we called each other cousins and didn't want to draw any attention to ourselves. Inside of me, I felt like that was a lie, and I didn't like telling that lie every day. It didn't feel good. And I've grown up doing some of those same things, and it's not, and it's only because, you know, you don't know what it's going to bring. It's a fear. And so about 15 years ago, my sister wife had a child pass away at 5 months old, natural causes, but there was an investigation, and the investigation was based upon our last name, and we've found evidence that that was the case, and we were a polygamous family, and therefore we must have been in some kind of neglect or abuse or something of that nature, which none of which was true, and it was dropped, you know, unfounded. But that spurred us into action for our family to not live in fear anymore. And it was scary. It's scary to come out and be public. It wasn't like, oh, let's write a book about our life and tell everybody who we are and go on TV and do, you know, interviews and put our name out there so, you know, the cops know where we are. it was scary a lot of times. And sometimes, you know, it still has been. For our family, it's been very healing and freeing, I would say, you know. And when our book came out, even though it wasn't decriminalized at that point, our children experienced a sense of freedom that they had never felt before, and it was wonderful for me to see that. In fact, I have a first grader, just started first grade, and he came home the second day of school, and they give you the teacher had given him a paper that said our family, and then a blank piece of paper and then a couple of lines, and he drew a picture of some people, and then he wrote on the bottom, I am polygamous, and it was spelled wrong, P-L-I-G-M-I-S-S, and I have 25 people in my family. And he was so proud of that. And, you know, with my first children, you know, 23 years ago, I would have been, like, I wouldn't even know what to do. Like, oh, you're not supposed to, you can't do that, just let's keep it down, you know, try not to freak out. But it was awesome not having to worry about that. And partly because of this ruling, but partly even before that, we had decided we are just going to be who we are. And it was great for him. It's great for him to not have to worry about that. It doesn't mean that's always the case, because there are still some, you know, teachers who may have issues with the whole idea of it, the morality standpoint of it, things like that. And I understand that. It's, you know, there's some things I think are immoral, but I don't feel like I can take people's choice away from how they want to live. We spent a lot of time on educating the public, because we felt like it was something that was needed and important, and there were so many misconceptions about it. So we did do a lot of television interviews or magazine and things like that. And then we actually did one sort of like reality show, but it was just like a one-hour special type thing. And those things it was a really good experience for us, for one, but it was also just great to see the reaction of a lot of people and hear people write on our blog, and they'll say, you've completely changed my paradigm. And that is a success. We count that as success for us, because while there are some problems and issues, I'm not going to deny that there have been and there are, we wanted to show that, you know, that's not our experience. Our family is one with a lot of love, and it's such a determination to make this work. And I don't know what I'd do without my sister wives. I really don't. And I probably couldn't even, it would have been really hard for me to even be here with a 9-month-old baby, you know, just with all the logistics, you know what that means. And people, some people are jealous of me sometimes when they go out like, oh, you're lucky, you can just, you know, if you have something you got to go do, you just can up and leave and you know it's taken care of. And I do, I have, I think the best of everything, the best that I can possibly have. And even not all polygamists experience it that way either. And that's fine too. It's however it works for them. And still, if they want to stay, even if, like my one sister wife, she left a plural marriage that wasn't working out. And there were some very big differences. And, you know what, she got out of it, she escaped, and then she wanted to come back into another one. She wanted the good that she could see in that, and saw that in our family. And but one of the things that one woman came up to her and she said, there's a lot of people talking and they say, you know, I can't imagine that you would go back into that. And I said to them, well, at least she's happy. And she said, that's no way to defend me. Don't defend me because I'm happy. I chose it. And whether I'm happy or not, I'm going to choose what I want. How many people do you know that choose not to be happy and seem to be in really good circumstances? I see a lot. And I see people that seem to be pretty upset. I mean, seem to be happy in some not that great circumstances. So, or what appears to me is not great circumstances. So, anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and would like to share some of the things that I've seen with the ruling of the decriminalization. I mean, for our family, like I said, we actually had a celebration the night we heard about it. And, you know, it was awesome and it was great and we were all just cheering. And then at the end we went, oh, but, you know, it could be appealed. So you still got to be careful. And, you know, those things may always loom over in our minds. That's how we've been raised, you know, with just kind of lay low and don't be too public because there's a mistrust of society and things like that just because you don't know, because we have been treated poorly by some people. And so it's like you are like a dog who's been on a leash or with a shock collar all this time, and then suddenly you can, you know, you have your freedom, but you're looking around and you're not sure what's going to happen. So, you know, patience and just testing out some waters and that kind of a thing is what we're going to do, and encourage all the people that we know to do those same things and just claim that freedom, no matter what it is, really. It's just, you know, nobody wants to be told what to do or what not to do, really, you know, and that's where we're standing, just in a place of love and freedom and empowerment for people, whatever that looks like. Thank you.
My name's Stan Shep, and I'm a Mormon. Top to bottom, left to right, inside out, through and through, blue-blooded Mormon. I believe it. I believe in Joseph Smith as a prophet of God. I believe in all of the doctrines that he reinstated and everything that he taught. I believe that plural marriage is an exalting principle. I don't think it's for everybody. I don't think there's going to be an explosion. People often look at the rights that you get with having more than one wife, but they don't look at the responsibilities. Let me tell you, there's a lot of responsibilities. And when you get a man that'll take on those responsibilities, and I'm not talking about myself, I'm talking about some of the men I associate with, they are great men. And I have no problem with God placing another woman or another woman choosing to be in that man's family because they put their trust in him to lead and guide them back to their Heavenly Father. I wasn't always a Mormon. I was born and raised Catholic. I didn't join the LDS church till I turned 24. I happened to live next door to anti-Mormons, and they gave me some anti-Mormon tracts that told me that Joseph Smith had more than one wife, and Brigham Young taught that Adam was God. And they were trying to talk me out of joining the church. But I read those footnotes, Journal of Discourses, and I went through them, and I studied those same things while I was gaining a testimony of the Book of Mormon and while I was meeting with the missionaries. And when I gained a testimony of the church, I was already a fundamentalist, and I lived in Pennsylvania. I didn't even know what a fundamentalist was. I ended up teaching gospel doctrine class in my ward back in Pennsylvania, and I would teach things that Brigham Young said, and I got called on it by the bishop's wife. And she'd say, "Where did you hear that?" I said, "Well, Brigham Young taught it. I read it in the Journal of Discourses." She said, "Well, we don't believe that anymore." I was like, "What? We don't believe Brigham Young was a prophet of God? We don't believe that he taught these things, and we don't believe that they're true?" Nope. Well, I did, and that seemed to be a problem for the church. It took them about 10 or 12 years to get rid of me, but I was a problem for the church because I believed too much, apparently. I got into a custody battle that ended up being about plural marriage, that I believed in plural marriage. I didn't have more than one wife. I didn't even know that there were polygamists in Utah. I didn't study it that hard. I mean, I studied the doctrines in the Millennial Star and in the Journal of Discourses, but through the course of that legal battle, my name got in the newspaper. I got on TV, got calls from Jerry Springer, turned him down. But my name got out there, and people started to send me requests for information. What's going on? What are you doing? You know, what's going on with your case? And one of these people continued to persistently ask me these questions, and I would answer the questions, what was going on with my case and what battles we were going through. And my case went from the county court to the Pennsylvania Superior Court and eventually to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, where I ultimately won. And then my ex appealed that to the U.S. Supreme Court, where they denied it. So the brunt of that was about my right to talk to my daughter about plural marriage, polygamy, and multiple wives. And so now I'm allowed to talk to her about that. Of course, she's 21 and married in the LDS Church, so she doesn't want to hear it. But through the course of that, I got some emails from a man that was in Centennial Park. And he would ask me, and I would tell him what was going on. And eventually, I asked him, I said, "Well, who are you?" Because I was getting requests for information from all over the world, but this guy seemed pretty consistent. So I said, "Well, who are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm just a like-minded person living in a community of like-minded people in northern Arizona." And I said, "Well, what's your priesthood line?" Because to me, that's what it's about. It's about priesthood. It's about who has the right, who has the authority, who's got the succession of keys that were restored. And he told me, and it was exactly what I was looking for, because in 1886, John Taylor was under pressure to give up plural marriage, and he prayed to the Lord to give up plural marriage or not, and the Lord gave him a revelation. September 26th, 27th, that evening, 1886, he received a revelation, and in that revelation, God told John Taylor that he had not and could not rescind the law of plural marriage. It's an everlasting covenant, and even though he's God, it was going to stand. And at that time, John Taylor knew that the church was going to give up plural marriage, so he set apart a group of people, a group of men, and charged them with these keys, and to make sure that plural marriage was lived on the earth from that day until Christ returned. And that priesthood council of men has had a succession from that day to this day, and there's a council that still exists that I go under the direction of, and I was called to live plural marriage under the direction of that council. And I didn't seek out a girl. A girl sought me out. Because for me, plural marriage isn't a man's law. It's not about a man's right to have more than one woman. It's about a woman and her rights, and her rights to choose who she marries, who she spends eternity with, and who she has children with, and who's the father of those children, and who helps her to raise those children. And I believe women should have that right, and I don't believe that they should be limited. And I think if you're in an LDS ward and the best man that you see is your stake president, then I think a woman should be able to marry him. And if the best man you see is your bishop, I think you should be able to marry him. Because I think that's a woman's right. And I think if your bishop or your stake president is man enough to take on that challenge, and it is a challenge, that I think he should step up and he should do that. Now, this law was passed, and it seems funny to me that when Utah became a state, the federal government came in and said, we'll let you become a state, but you have to give up plural marriage. And now 100-some-odd years later, it's the federal government that's coming back into Utah and saying, well, wait a minute, you got these laws in the books that say you can't live a plural marriage. It just seems crazy to me. When we let people that aren't directed by God to try to direct us, we're going to get lost. And we need to have a confirmation from the Lord on the things that we do and the people who guide us and who lead us and who give us direction. And I can ask anybody I want for counsel. I can ask my barber for counsel. I can ask my former LDS bishop for counsel. I can ask one of the leaders in our community for counsel. One of the things that I look at is, we have our IQ, and I'll just say a person with an average IQ of 100 lives 50 years, and the math doesn't actually work out, but if you multiply that out, this person would have an experience ratio of 5,000. But when you take a polygamous man that has literally been married for 250 years and has raised 50 children, and I'm talking about he has 50 years of experience raising one-year-olds. He has 50 years of experience raising two-year-olds. He has 50 years of experience raising three-year-olds. And that goes on. This man would have a knowledge quotient that is off the charts. When I go to one of my leaders for counsel, I'm talking to a man that has a lot of experience. A lot of experience growing up in the community that he grew up in, a lot of experience in the family that he's providing for, that he's working with the wives that he has, with the problems that they have interacting, that he has to mediate, with the problems that they have and he has raising the children. This isn't a person that just fell off the turnip truck. This is a guy that has a lot of experience. And when I go and ask them counsel and ask them for counsel, I don't just have to take it. I get to pray about it. I get to ask him, I get to ask the Lord if it's the right thing for me to do to follow that counsel. But let me tell you, these guys have incredible knowledge, just a wealth of experience in their lives. I am so grateful to be associated with them and to have that resource that I can look to ask these questions. Because I'm 50. I still have questions. My oldest child's 30. My youngest is in the womb. I've still got questions. I still run into things. I think that it's great that this law came down. It's a step in the right direction. It's not completely where we need to be. And I'm not talking about I need a marriage license from the state for every wife or every woman that comes into my life. I don't need that. I don't need a government-sanctioned marriage. I don't have any right now. None of my wives are legally married to me. My thoughts at the time were that if I played their game, I had to play by their rules, and I didn't like their rules, so I opted out of the game. So none of my marriages are through the state. But we are still a persecuted people. So it's not a third-degree felony. That's great. I can still lose my job. That's not great. A gay man can walk into a bakery and order a cake for his wedding. And if the baker says he doesn't want to make a cake for him, they can sue him and win. But if I'm building buildings and I'm doing construction, and the company that I'm working for finds out that I'm a polygamist, they don't even have to ask me to bid on another job. They don't have to look at me. And I get it often. I live in St. George, or I live in Centennial. I work in St. George, and I work with a lot of LDS people. And it's okay for them to persecute us. It's okay for them to mock us. It's okay for them to say things under their breath as we walk around. It's okay for them to deny me work. And that's a problem. That's a problem that I think needs to be overcome. I still have work. I mean, there's plenty of people that don't care. But it's still a problem. And I'm sure it's a problem in Salt Lake. When people find out that Joe's building a house, and then they go, oh, Joe's on TV, Joe wrote a book. Wait a minute, I don't think I want to give my money to Joe. I had an incident at the company I was working for, and we went golfing together. We had a nice golf outing, and I had gotten a ticket the night before, a fix-it ticket for my taillight was out, and he pulled me over, and I didn't have my insurance card, and I texted my wife at home, and she emailed it to me on my phone, my other wife was sitting in the car, and she was looking through the glove compartment. Well, I was telling these guys I was doing some work for her, and I was like, yeah, my wife was looking through the glove compartment for it, and then my wife texted it to me, and I had it. And he's like, how many wives do you have? I was like, the cat's out of the bag. I said, two. Is that a problem? He said, yeah, might be. Might be. Depends on where your tithing goes. You paying tithing? He said, I pay tithing. And I looked at him and I said, in case you're wondering, the only money that comes from you, that comes to me, that gets to Warren Jeff's, is when I stop at the coffee shop on my way to work and buy a cup of coffee. I think that he kind of runs that and gets some money from that coffee. But if you want me to, I'll buy my coffee somewhere else. But I don't give any tithing to Warren Jeffs. He doesn't get anything from me. And he was like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we'll be able to work with you or not. So that's the kind of things we still run into. And those are the kind of things that need to be resolved. We're normal people. I love my children. Vicky loves her children. Polly loves her children. Heck, I love Polly's children. I love some of Vicky's children. I don't know them all, but the ones I know I love. They're good people. They're raised by a good family. I know that. We can judge a family by their fruits, and I know that Joe and Vicky have some really good kids. I'm really looking forward to answering any questions that you have. I'm not sure what you came here to look for, what answers you were looking for when you showed up, so I'm hoping to save a little time to allow you to ask those questions. So I'm going to sit down. Thanks a lot.
Stan claims he wants to give you a Q&A time, but he also made a point of pushing a few buttons before I came in the room so that I would make sure I have plenty to say. So somebody just, you know, wave at me if I get very long-winded. My name is Polly. I grew up in a large plural family. I feel really blessed to have had that experience. I have never been lonely in my entire life. I have people who have my best interests at heart. And I run into them all the time. I live with them. I live in the community of them. I call some of them family. I call all of them friends. And it's an incredible experience. And I feel sometimes like I've cheated my sisters in broader society. Because I see their stories. And my heart aches for so many of them. I am married to a good man. He will never leave me. Ever. I know that as sure as I drew a breath a second ago. I don't know about my next breath, but I know I drew one a second ago, and I have absolute knowledge he will never leave me. We had an interesting experience happen at our house. We were watching a movie, and in the movie, the plot line was that this girl met her father when she was 17 for the first time. And we're watching the movie, and my son, he's about 10, is perplexed as to how she's meeting her father for the first time. You know, and so I'm trying to get into his head and figure out why. What is he really trying to ask me? And I says, honey, your dad would never leave us. You know that, right? because that is what had happened to the girl that had had this child. He goes, oh, well, I didn't know that. My children live in absolute knowledge that their family is staying in their lives. And I just feel like I've cheated. That I got a deal that wasn't offered to everybody. And so I feel bad. I do. I feel bad for so many women whose experience is such that the first thing that they learn about marriage is that they have to compete. And to do that, they sell themselves short, many of them. They send messages to themselves and from society at large. They have messages sent to them that talk about a value that is non-existent. It's physical. It may be attached to other external things, but so many of their beautiful characteristics are overlooked. So they have to compete. Then the next thing they have to do is they have to keep him. When they get to be my age, if he doesn't choose to stick around, her likely chances of remarrying are pretty much non-existent. Not totally, but pretty much. So many women choose to marry serially in polygamy. They find a good man that will marry and father their children and give them those rights and privileges. And then the next woman wants a chance to have that same opportunity. And I just feel bad. I didn't get up here to talk about that. I don't know where it came from, but I do want you to know that my life is a blessed life. And I've had a tremendous amount of experiences, having opportunities to talk to women. You know, I have 5 post-high school degrees, so I've had an opportunity to be out in the classroom a lot. Just as a little story, when I got my master's degree, our family got together. Vicki talks about the support. Our family got together and decided that it would be better for me to get done and come home than it would be for me to take X number of months to try to get finished. So for 1 year, I didn't make one meal. I did no laundry. And I did no house cleaning. The time I had outside of classes and my work, I was able to spend with my children. When my peers in my classes found that to be the case, I had more than one that were a little upset. They're like, of course you can get done in this many months. I'm like, yeah, of course I can. Because I have a tremendous amount of support. Repercussions of this law are interesting. The overturning of this. Because I don't know that at the heart of the law, that part ever got legislated, and that is prejudice. I think it just was put into words for many, many people, and so overturning the law hasn't really overturned prejudice. And so you still find people when you walk into St. George or where I do my shopping at Costco, I still find people who can't spot me. I am spotted. I have 2 great big huge grocery carts. Clear, clearful. I had one lady tell me once, she says, I'm sure glad those aren't my carts. And I looked at her and I said, you know what? My kids are sure glad they're not yours too. Our lives are about the expansion of the heart, expansion of capacities, and You know, that kind of smallness is everywhere around us. It's just hard sometimes to come face to face with it, because I've taught for, 28 years now. I've taught young people that they live in the most wonderful country on the planet, and that this country has this mindset about who we are as individuals and what we have as freedoms. And then I have to always follow that talk up with, but you aren't included in that class of citizens. So prejudice isn't legislated, and I see a great part of the work that we have to do of the overturning of this, and it is probably going to have an appeal, but even in the initial stages of it, I think a tremendous amount of the work is still to deal with the prejudice that we find in the communities. That's partially education. You know, I like to invite the people that check out my groceries to come to Sunday dinner if they'd like, because I think part of it is just to come up close with people. You'll find that they're normal, everyday people, just like everyone else. And, you know, we have a bigger Sunday table, more people at it, but it's an awfully wonderful Sunday table. And any of you are welcome there. When I joined CPAC, and we knew, because our first presentations, how silly we were, our very first presentations as an organized body was to the Attorneys General of the states of Arizona and Utah. And I was one of those presenters. And for a year, I had full-blown panic attacks 2 or 3 times every week. I would wake up and I couldn't breathe, and because I knew I had put everything that I held close, I had put everything under somebody's microscope. And I still feel like I'm under their microscope. I just always feel like there's something waiting for them to find some way to come. And so when she talked about that's just kind of our, you know, that's going to be a piece that we're going to have to breathe through, and we're going to have to figure a way around, because it's very, very difficult to get past the mindset that is what people are looking to do, is to find a way to destroy our lives. I thought about the question of this panel for quite a bit, and obviously there's the reality pieces. CPAC has dedicated the proposition that we would want to see Reynolds overturned at the Supreme Court level, so we have more work to do on that level. But there's a very personal side to this, and I thought, I know this is kind of a weird thing since many of you don't know me. I thought, you know, today I can be Polly. I can be a mother who has many children, and I can share for the very first time what it feels like to be us, I guess, in one small aspect. So I thought I'd share a piece. I happen to have a notebook here that I jotted a few notes down for this event, and it happened to have a piece that I wrote for my daughter in it. She was married last year. And I was reading it just as I was thumbing through, and I thought, you know, this is kind of at the heart of what we do. So maybe, you know, it's a small thing, but maybe it'll give you an idea. For my daughter. "I think you should be brave," said the mother to the daughter. "Plant your love within this family. Set it on the heart of its father and into the blooming days of its mothers. Light as a butterfly's wings. Kiss its sons and daughters. Do not worry about being too soft or too strong. Let softness be your strength and humility your courage. Let love ride on you. Think only of the way your gift will color eternity. Thank you.
We've had an interesting panel here that has of people who have spoken from their heart about the love that they have in their plural families. And I would not want to take that away from them. I would not want to see them thrown in jail. I would not want to see their families broken up. I would not want to see their children have to continue to lie. But I'm going to rain on your parade a little bit. In Jennifer's remarks, she said that the judge said that the attorney general had not presented any evidence of harm. I don't remember exactly what you said, Jennifer, but it was no evidence of no compelling evidence that there was harm flowing from. Greater harm in polygamous families than in monogamous families. Okay. Okay. In Canada, about, I think it was in 2010, there was a major trial that looked very closely at the situation with polygamy up there. And just because the Attorney General here did not present any compelling evidence of harm does not mean that there isn't any. So I want to tell you some of the things that the court in Canada found, and then I'd like our panelists to have a chance to respond and to maybe talk about how these harms can be avoided, because I think that's something that you need to do if you're going to make your case for your lifestyle. The Canadian court had a trial that took place over a two-year period. They had 44 actual days of trial, more than 100 witnesses, thousands of pages of written exhibits and reports, including more than 90 affidavits and expert reports, and it resulted in a 350-page decision by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of British Columbia, based on what he called the most comprehensive judicial record of the subject ever produced. And he said, on the whole of the evidence here, I conclude that the attorneys general have certainly demonstrated a reasoned apprehension of harm associated with polygyny. Indeed, they have cleared the higher bar. They have demonstrated concrete evidence of harm. I have detailed that evidence at length. I have discussed the varied nature of the harms associated with polygyny and highlighted their coincidence across nations, cultures, and socioeconomic units. Now, some of the harms that he detailed. Women in polygamous relationships are at an elevated risk of physical and psychological harm. Now, that does not mean that every woman who's in a polygamous relationship is at risk of harm. And we've heard from these women who feel very blessed by their polygamous relationships. But what this is saying is that there's a statistically significant increased risk of physical and psychological harm. They face higher rates of domestic violence and abuse, including sexual abuse. Competition for material and emotional access to a shared husband can lead to fractious, co-rife relationships. These factors contribute to higher rates of depressive disorders and other mental health issues that women in polygamous relationships face. They have more children and are more likely to die in childbirth and live shorter lives than their monogamous counterparts. They tend to have less autonomy. They report higher rates of marital dissatisfaction and lower levels of self-esteem. They also fare worse economically, as resources may be inequitably divided or simply insufficient. Children in polygamous families face higher infant mortality, even controlling for economic status and other relevant variables. They tend to suffer more emotional, behavioral, and physical problems, as well as lower educational achievement than children in monogamous families. These outcomes are likely the result of higher levels of conflict, emotional stress, and tension in polygamous families. In particular, rivalry, jealousy among co-wives can cause significant emotional problems for their children. The inability of fathers to give sufficient affection and disciplinary attention to all of their children can further reduce children's emotional security. Children are also at enhanced risk of psychological and physical abuse and neglect. The sex ratio imbalance inherent in polygamy means that young men are forced out of polygamous communities to sustain the ability of senior men to accumulate more wives. These young men and boys often receive limited education as a result and must navigate their way outside their communities with few life skills and social support. Polygamy's harms to society includes the critical fact that a great many of its individual harms are not specific to any particular religious, cultural, or regional context. They can be generalized and expected to occur wherever polygamy exists. The evidence, in particular that of Drs. Heinrich and McDermott, who were two of the expert witnesses who have studied polygamy all over the world, supports the reasoned view that the harms associated with the practice are endemic. They are inherent. This conclusion is critical because it supports the view that the harms found in polygynous societies are not simply the product of individual misconduct. They arise inevitably out of the practice. Now, my experience with polygamists over the last several years has been not with these good people, but with Utah's most dysfunctional polygamists, that would be the FLDS. And I could not even begin to tell you how dysfunctional the FLDS are right now. And I'm sure that every polygamist in this room would agree with me. Yes, that's true, and that's a good point. That trial arose based on allegations regarding the FLDS in Canada, and that is a good point. However, it's also true that the expert witnesses were not confined solely to that group. That the experts had done research all over the world, including other countries, and including in France. One of the things I found compelling about the decision was the evidence of what happened in France, which is a first world country, and they allowed polygamy after World War II because they needed workers to come in. They came in from Africa, and then they wound up making the polygamists not allowing polygamy to occur anymore because of the problems that existed there. So, you know, I'm not saying that, I don't want any of you to think that I'm saying that anything like this is existing in your communities.
But I think what needs to be said is that a common thread through the studies that you're citing, and I'm very familiar with them as well, and as a cultural anthropologist, my PhD is in...
Wait a minute. Why don't you wait a minute, and then you can take the mic because they can't hear you. So wait.
Just real quick.
Okay.
I just want to say that the common thread that's running through these is you have uneducated communities that are isolated and that are cut off from mainstream society. Mm-hmm. And anybody who does that, regardless of their structure, I'm willing to say if we were able to fund a study that looked at monogamous relationships where there's not access to education, there's not access to health care, there's not access to what we would consider in the Western world positive living environment, you'd see the same things. And the type of plural marriage we're talking about here and today, and this is really important because this gets forgotten all the time, is that there is nothing about anyone on this panel that is anti-education or right. anti any of this. And so it's not polygamy, it's how polygamy is lived.
Okay. And that's a really good point, and it's a really important point. But my question would be, if we decriminalized polygamy pending appeal, and as you've pointed out, in most states, what the polygamous communities in Utah do is not illegal, although it is in Texas. One of the convictions in Texas was for polygamy. I'm not an attorney in Arizona, but as I understand it, those of you who are in Centennial Park are already living in a place where polygamy is decriminalized. Is that correct? In Arizona, it's already decriminalized.
It's
right. So
it's not a criminal statute.
You're right. It's not a crime in Arizona. So those of you in Centennial Park who are in Arizona, where you're living, you're already living under decriminalization.
I know, and we have an award-winning school.
What?
We have an award-winning school, National Blue Ribbon Award-winning School, 2008.
Yeah, that would be El Capitan.
Just a few of these things that might not happen.
Not El Capitan? No, okay.
No,
it's not?
It's
okay.
The Masada Charter School in Centennial Park.
Okay. All right.
El Cap got their own award from Newsweek. They took a bronze.
Good for them. And I know that's true, but if we say that polygamy is going to be decriminalized, then it isn't just you good people who are going to be practicing it. So what do we do to prevent these kinds of harms from happening in a society where we allow polygamy and the people who are practicing it aren't as good as you people? So I'd like to...
Thank you.
All right.
I'll just finish here. I thought that was your question. No, I'm sorry.
It kind of is my question. I'm just going to finish and then allow you to respond to everything that I've said. And then after that, I'm going to let people in the audience ask questions. So the time is yours.
May I? Okay. The first thing I'd like to start with is a comment on the way women have been treated since records have been kept. Women have been property. Women have been chattel. Women have not been able... I can delineate for you the journey to women's rights. And many of those... I mean, if we just start in the American story, many of those stories are in a monogamous union. And I'm sorry... You cannot take the failings of human beings and attach it to the way people choose to live. I mean, that's the exact argument that was leveled against the gays. Passion. Let me just boil it down just a second. Yeah. Choosing to follow a leader that is a megalomaniac, and in that megalomania gives you directives that have nothing to do with the fact that there's more than one woman in a house or more than one woman. It calls people's ability to reason into question. I'm sorry. There's pieces at play here that have nothing to do with plural marriage. Nothing. And the fact that we would say, well, there's somebody over there that beat his wife, ergo every marriage. I mean, the divorce rate is climbing past 50%. Is that to say that monogamy should now be banned because over 50% of couples have found it not to be worthy to stay together? Children have been disrupted. They're harmed. I'm not speaking to the fact that there's not challenge in life, and that there's not challenge in the relationships that we have with one another. I don't want to paint an inaccurate picture of my life, and please don't let me do that for you. But for you, for anyone, let me pull it back, for anyone to deny me the right to live the articles of my faith and to worship God according to my conscience, well, please, let's just take a minute, look out through history, and see where that has taken other people. We have an entire story of ghettos and concentration camps and extermination orders. Because that's what it's going to take, ladies and gentlemen. You will have to kill us.
And I think if I could just speak to why we all, I think, I don't have a very good poker face despite living in Las Vegas, are bothered by this kind of a discussion. It's because you already know that story. You know that narrative. You know that script. You hear it every day. You can flip news channels, movie channels, sensationalize news reports. And it's not to deny that that happens. It absolutely does. It's horrifying. These abuses should stop. They should be prosecuted. But that's not the only story about polygamy. It just isn't. And I have to tell you, 4 years ago when I started this field work, I kind of thought it was. So this isn't me saying polygamy's awesome and I'm so sorry I'm not living it and let's just shout from the rooftops how fantastic it is. Okay, this is me on a personal journey doing really hard field work. I mean, the people that I'm surrounded with here that are practicing plural marriage have become dear friends. I've seen their struggles. I've seen their families. They're no different from my family, except for when they all came to our house and a couple extra people showed up, it was no big deal. And we were like, I don't know if we have enough folding chairs. You know the bad story about polygamy. We just want to counterbalance that with the reality that there's a lot of good, and you just don't hear that. Not enough.
One of the things the judge said in the ruling was that there were already laws in place to take care of many of those issues within plural families that seem to be at the forefront of some people's minds. And there are, and I don't know about all those statistics and stories. I mean, from my view, it doesn't look like that. But I don't want to take away anybody else's story if that's their experience of it. Also, so the laws can take care of those things. I also know one fact. There is not one death in a domestic violence case in a polygamous family. There might be abuse. I don't know what year it was. I think it was last year, partway into the year, I went down to the domestic violence office building for Salt Lake, and they had a red thumbtack on places where a death had occurred in a domestic violence situation for that year, and it was over 200. There's problems, and that's why, one of the reasons why our family, I told you, one of my sister wives really got into outreach, because she could see that, and there needs to be education. The other thing is who made them into a closed society? Just they decided one day, we don't like everyone? I'm not saying you guys are all responsible, but we're all connected, and if there are them that are closed society or feel that they have to lie or hide, where'd that come from? I mean, just to take a little bit broader look of some of those things too, I would suggest.
I have a couple things. Closer? All right. Closer. All right. I've seen some statistics on abuse, and the only abuse that I've found in plural societies that don't exist or doesn't exist in monogamous societies is sister wife on sister wife abuse. But if you take into account wife versus ex-wife or wife versus girlfriend, it's exponentially in our favor the small amount of wife on sister wife abuse that we have. So I wanted to mention that. The other thing I want to mention, I often hear this, boys have to be kicked out of the community to make the numbers work, and that's not the case. Boys don't have to be kicked out. Boys are not kicked out of our community. And I'd just like to run a couple numbers by you, and I'll try to use round numbers to make it easy. I'll say our community has a 3% growth rate, and assume we have 100 boys and 100 girls that graduate from school this year. Those boys probably won't get married right away. Those girls may. Next year, with a 3% growth rate, we'll have 103 boys and 103 girls. And the year after that, we'll have 106 boys and 106 girls. Well, the 106, or the 100 girls marry the into the 106 because, yeah.
Because the boys
because
marry
the boys are 2 years older. Okay. So there's each year there's 3% less. So there's okay. There's a difference. So every year, if all of the boys and all of the girls got married, there would be an additional 6 girls that there wouldn't be a boy for, because those girls are marrying boys 2 years older than them.
Statistically, women choose organized religion in quite greater numbers. In the Church of England, for example, there's five women in the church for a single man. We see that same racial differential in the LDS church with their single wards. They have a tremendous amount of single women for the single men. What plural marriage allows for is for women to choose to be mothers and wives if they want to. It just doesn't put them on the shelf and tell them to wait until the next life, I guess. It gives that difference in the ratio of women that want to stay in a spiritually organized society as opposed to having to leave and find their mate outside their faith.
I'm almost done. All right, I do want to take some questions. In a plural society, we don't necessarily have a single mother problem. If something happens and a divorce happens or a husband dies and there's single mothers, they can get remarried. We have eligible men in our communities, and so we don't have a single mother problem.
Well, you should probably underscore that they can choose to get remarried. It's
they
not
can
like
choose.
A claimant thing, because I know you've heard about that with Warren Jeffs. It's not that at all.
And the other thing is that I think is really important that this law helps us with is it allows the light of day to shine on our families. Once you take a family and you have to hide behind the walls of your home, things happen that don't get reported. But if the light of day is allowed to shine on us, then you can see how I treat my family. You can see how I treat my children. My wife and two of my children are going to come today, and I wish they would have, because I would love you to see what these little plig boys, how cute they are.
Because
yeah. Friend me on Facebook and you'll see I have adorable children and I'm not the only one.
Yeah, and I would have to say that I think the ability of someone to come forward if they're being abused is probably one of the best arguments for decriminalizing polygamy. Because if a woman is in a polygamous relationship and she is being abused and she is a felon for being in a polygamous relationship, that definitely has a chilling effect on her ability to come forward. I will now open it up to questions. Whoever comes up there first, I'd like you to check the microphone and see if it's working.
Is it working? Okay.
You hear him back there? Okay, yes.
I will speak loudly. And I will stand close to the mic. Okay. A couple of comments. First of all, I happen to be LDS. I happen to believe in plural marriage. And the reason that I believe in plural marriage is because Section 132 is in our Doctrine and Covenants. And even if I didn't want to believe, I would have to believe because I believe that is Scripture and from God. Stan, I remember when York, Pennsylvania was the center of the universe.
Centennial Park is now.
Centennial Park is now, I know. Polly? I remember when you were up here with the CPAC group last year or the year before. I was impressed with you then. I still am. Vicki, I met you and Joe and your sister wives up at Benchmark when you did that presentation with your book. Your book was absolutely marvelous. It taught me a lot. And Jennifer, thank you for all the work that you're doing. Now, one of the things that just tore me up was when I was up at Benchmark and Joe was talking, and he was talking about how your family has been treated by some of your neighbors. Now, I don't think it was all your neighbors, but some of your neighbors. And I remember him saying that he would drive down the street and wave, and people would turn their backs. Has this law changed that at all? If it hasn't, your neighbors are still jerks. But anyhow, God bless all of you.
I don't know if the neighbors that don't wave even know about the ruling. No, it hasn't changed that. Polly said you can't legislate, what was it, prejudice. But there has been a lot of people that when their last argument was, well, it's against the law. You know, because a lot of people would say, well, what about this, what about that? And everything we would say, well, there's this. And then at the end they'd say, well, it's still against the law. So now there's that for us. There's a little safety in that.
Recently, the past church historian talked about how the internet had had a huge effect on the LDS community, and that they've had the largest number of apostasy because of the internet recently that they've had since Kirtland. So I was wondering, as far as the fundamentalist community, what do you do about people having access to two different kinds of information? There's two things where people are attacked. One is scholarship and things that have to do with attacking Christianity in general, and then other ones that are impinging on the character of Joseph Smith. What do you have free flow of information that may be negative about Joseph Smith or negative about Christianity in your homes, or do you try to stop that, or do you try to inoculate, isolate? What's your philosophy on how to deal with that?
My experience, because I was LDS and I was on the internet, and I found information on the internet that made me feel like I had been lied to by the church. The dealings with plural marriage had been lied about. The teachings about Adam God had been lied about. It made me feel like I was going to a church that didn't teach truth but hid it. When I went to a fundamentalist community, I was openly given the Journal of Discourses. Read these. These are where our doctrine comes from. I was told that the what we call the four hidden revelations that weren't adopted, but were given to the presence of the church, we believe in. These are doctrines that God revealed and are part of our religion. I have unlimited internet access in my home, and I don't know any home that doesn't. Polly might know some because she's a teacher, but I have as much internet as I can handle. It could be faster.
there is some things about being in the big city that it has its perks. I would say, in as a mother's experience, I think for our children that have chosen not to embrace our faith, that the crisis of faith that they had was not one of a difference of the story that they were told. It was more of, is this my journey? Is this going to be my story? And we have children who love coming home, love our family, but have chosen something different. Well, they are. Oh, absolutely. Of course they're welcome. When you ask someone who truly believes Mormonism, if a family member chooses not to embrace it, you're asking them if they really love that person, right? Of course it breaks my heart if they choose not to, because I love them. But the flip of that is it does not stop my love for them. It has not been cut off. They're welcome home.
And just to add to that real quickly, having grown up in the Mormon church, I didn't leave until I was about 25, directly connected to the September 6th of 1993. It was a real crisis of faith for me. And the problem with the internet and apostasy is that for me and for many that have shared this experience, it's because you find a different story than the one you've been told. And as far as my understanding of Centennial Park in particular, it's a consistent story. There's no aha moment of the internet says this, but I've been told this, and there isn't that disconnect. that there is in the mainstream Mormon church, because so much has changed for interpretation or wanting to not have documents available to everyone and that kind of thing. So it's much more of a consistent story.
Yeah, I just wanted to say we do have a large supply of info at our home and the internet, and we encourage our children to read and study other things as well. And my oldest son is 23 years old, is on a mission right now for the LDS Church. He, on his own accord, joined the church, went on a mission to Taiwan. Full support. I think it's great. You know, before he did that, he was actually reading a lot of anti-Mormon stuff. That kind of hurt my heart, but at the same time, I had to go, he's going to choose, and I just prayed hard. You know, he's going to decide and make decisions for his life, and I prayed really hard, and I believed in what was in the Book of Mormon, that the prayer of a mother can bring about things for her children, and I think I got that. So, and I'm still happy with where he is.
So. It's 6:30 now, and so it's time for the session to end. However, do you want to stay a few more minutes and answer questions? So maybe another 10 minutes or so?
Whatever they need.
Anybody who feels like they need to leave, feel free to do that. We won't think you're being rude. But if there are still a few more questions and our guests are willing, let's continue.
Thanks. I've got some notes here. I'll limit it greatly. In short, though, thanks for all your candor and your sharing with us. A few things that come to mind. I guess I'll draw on Vicki's story, where her son made a show-and-tell project out of him describing his faith and misspelling the polygamy. And I'm climbing into that story, and I'm admiring the candid, fun naivety of your child as he's simply sharing a part of his life, not knowing the politic, perhaps it swirls around the way adults interpret all these things. My next thought is it would be nice to actually have a kind of comparative religions class, you know, on the elementary level, where that takes some of the edge off some of these topics for kids, because kids, they begin to calibrate the importance of things based on what the adults in their life now respond to. And when they see venom and anger and angst that surround topics, they see that's a big deal. And I guess my question here would be, would you invite sincere, curious outsiders to visit your version of sacrament meeting, or whether that person is doing a college project or not, maybe it's just some college friends that want to respect the situation?
Our church services are open to anyone that would like to come. They're at 2 o'clock Utah time in the Centennial Park Chapel.
You got a website?
Not for church services. CPAC has a website. .org, is it? We can get it to you later.
Very good. Thank you.
And just to add to that, I will say that even though...
I'll hand you the mic.
They say it's open. No.
Here's Jennifer.
They say it's open and anyone can come. They really mean it. I mean, they really mean it. You know, once you've been once, they'll remember you when you come again, and then you're welcome. But the first time I went, I was freaking out. Because here I am in the middle of nowhere. This is before they had cell towers for AT&T. So I'm like, I am totally isolated with the polygamists. And it was fantastic, and they were open-armed, and they accepted me without question. So if you're down there and you want to go. They're very serious about anyone being welcome.
Not the first time she came in.
Not the first time. I had to build that up.
People have come with cameras. We like notification for that. But.
All right. Now, okay, good. The mic's working. I'm getting this question sort of from something you said in particular, Stan, but, you know, if any of you else want to respond, I'm obviously open to that. And my question is, you know, I enjoyed hearing the math you brought up when you were talking about, you know, how boys don't kicked out of your communities or don't get kicked out, you know, unlike the popular misconception. However, a minute later, I also heard you sort of implicitly acknowledge that, you know, if a husband died, then there would be a single man available. So I'm curious, A, is there an excess of single men in your communities? Or I guess maybe excess is not the right word, but are there always men who are not married? And if that's the case, how do you deal with the potential problems that could cause? Thank you.
Well, what I had mentioned was if the man dies, that the woman would not have to spend the rest of her life as a single woman. We have available men. As far as single men, I think Brigham Young said that a single man is his own worst enemy. And as Perry brought up with the internet, a single man with the internet is so far beyond his worst enemy that Brigham Young couldn't even comprehend it. It's not my problem. I'm not on the council that makes those decisions, but my guess is that those problems get rectified as soon as they're able to. I hope that helps.
He actually said over 25, they're a menace to society. Also, because I remember because Steve Young, the football player, would quote that about himself. Being a descendant of Brigham Young, he was well aware that he was a menace to society. My question was about the letter that you, or the community that, okay, I think it was you, Stan, right, yeah. That was talking about the, okay, now I don't even know who said it, but talking about the community being established to preserve the practice of plural marriage. So how does that play out, like, in your holy writings kind of thing? Like, do you have additional documents, like, that are also sacred or considered, like, a revelation that was past the point where, as an LDS person that I would have not been aware of, that you have somehow, like, printed or in your books or just, like, available somehow?
Are you asking about continuing revelation?
No, but I should have asked about contributing revelation. That's a really good question. No, I was just asking, like, because I had heard that there was, like, a letter or something that was authorizing.
We
you said there's four. Okay.
If you have access to the internet and you Google four hidden revelations or John Taylor,
maybe I didn't connect that. Okay.
You can get those revelations. If you're looking for additional teachings from our community, we've been publishing books that contain the discourses that have been given at our meetings. Basically 50 years ago. So 1960, 1961, 1962, 1963, probably up till 1965 or so. And there's more coming. And the purpose of, one of the purposes of those books being published by our community is to show that the doctrines that were taught in fundamentalism 50 years ago are the same doctrines that you'll hear over our pulpit today. So if you can't come to church in Centennial Park Sunday, 2:00, we can get copies of those books for you, and you can read, and you'll find the same doctrines taught then that you'll find today.
Okay, and I guess when you were talking about the four things, I didn't connect what that really was.
There were four revelations that concerned plural marriage. The main one was 1886, John Taylor.
And are they in a book form,
in
like
a
along with like your Doctrine and Covenants, for example, or something like that?
We usually purchase the Doctrine and Covenants. I mean, it's published by the LDS Church, and so we purchase our Doctrine and Covenants, our four scriptures from the LDS Church. We do publish the four hidden revelations. We publish some of the work of Joseph Musser. He did a piece on celestial marriage. It's a book about that thick. Mediation and Atonement. It's another book. So we have scripture that we use outside the LDS scripture, and we have scripture that the LDS no longer has need of that we use also.
In regards to Joseph Musser, he published the Truth magazines for 26 years, and there's a wealth of information in those. It's a whole set of books.
It was a magazine. They're just bound.
It was a monthly magazine that was published by
M-U-S-S-E-R kind of thing?
M-U-S-S-E-R. Okay. Truth magazine. You can probably get a set of reprints for like $400, which isn't bad.
This has been really informative and eye-opening, and I just wanted to comment that in the LDS Church you hear a lot about people who fall away because they can't really accept the teaching of polygamy, or accept that it existed in the church before. But I believe that probably just a great portion of those people, if they had attended this today, would change their minds.
Thank you.
It seems to me, can you hear me?
Barely.
All right. It seems to me that it's pretty clear that gay marriage is going to be settled law across the land pretty soon. Do you see plural marriage being legalized, not just decriminalized, but actually legalized? And the second part of my question is, if so, what do you think about marriages between groups of people?
First off, I guess we kind of like the fact that in Utah, at least, plural marriage was decriminalized before gay marriage, because that was the whole argument about against the gays, is that they would decriminalize plural marriage if they decriminalized or legalized gay marriage, that the polygamists would be right behind. So we kind of liked it in Utah, at least it got flipped. But I know they were peeling it all as fast and as hard as they can, probably. But to answer your question about the legalization, we find that it was the Reynolds decision that put the state into marriage in the first place. Our marriages are spiritually binding marriages. I think that there's pieces of the legal question that we would be not particularly interested in. And that it would be, you know, at what point does the state start saying, we're going to manage this for you? The other side of that is, as a plural wife, it would be lovely to be able to have the right to go into a hospital room if my husband was dying and have some of the same rights as his legal wife. So I think that there's pieces there that we would absolutely embrace. There's pieces of it I'm not sure that we've thought it all the way through and are really interested in some of the ramifications. You know, unintended consequences can go, you know, in a lot of directions. And then as far as the group thing, I don't think you can legislate morality. And I think if people choose something for their own lives, that's the choosing that they do. I'm not interested in being in anybody else's bedroom any more than I'm interested in having them in mine.
Let me just ask a follow-up question about that, because the possible legalization of plural marriage or group marriage or whatever we want to call it, I mean, whatever shape that concept takes, I don't think anything other than two-person marriage should be legalized without a thorough vetting under the law to think about, because that's a very different thing than legalizing two people of the same sex who get married, because they fit right into the existing scheme. But if we legalize plural marriage in any form, then we have to look at how do we revamp all the laws, all the inheritance laws, the property laws, who gets the pension. So, okay. Yeah, sure.
First off, all of those are contracts, and we take care of all of that through contractual obligations outside of marriage anyway, if we want to do it so. The other part of it is in many cases, our families are really made of good-hearted people, and so, like, when my father died, there wasn't this big, huge fight over his stuff, and there was...
But you can't generalize it, so what do we do? Well,
my first reaction to your question was... maybe not so nice. I would give it to you. You know, if you wanted to come into our community and women wanted to marry, I wouldn't take my husband and hide him in the closet from you and say, he's a good man, but you can't have him. I would be willing to share benefits that come in my life. I don't understand why other people aren't willing to share benefits reciprocally. I don't get that. I hear you. I'm 47. I don't know that I drew breath in a country
were that they were willing to give that to me. But I would give it to you, and I would give it to, and I don't understand someone not being willing to say to someone else, have what is good, please, with my blessing.
And I think as far as the issue of group marriage or more than one person and one person that you're talking about, it would need to be vetted. But guess what? Marriage wasn't perfect when it became government sanctioned. Women were property for a long time. In many instances, it's argued that a married woman can't possibly be raped by her husband. I mean, there are all sorts of flaws with marriage that the legal system is playing catch-up for. I will always come down on the side of consenting adults should be able to structure their family as they see fit. And if we have to make legal changes and we stumble a little bit, just as we did with traditional marriage, then so be it. I mean, I guess I'll see you in 10 years talking about group marriage, Ed. I guess.
Can I ask a follow-up? Well,
I just want to say I really look forward to the legalization of it, because every time I fill out a form that says, asks if I'm married, I don't know what to say. I'm more married than most, but legally I'm not. And if I say that I am, I might be in trouble. And if I say that I'm not, I might be in trouble. I try to do my taxes at the end of the year. It's absurd. I wish I have to file as single. I got a household. I look forward to the direction that comes, and it's going to be work.
Do I dare ask a follow-up question? I recognize... Okay, I recognize that the Constitution of Utah says that polygamy is forever prohibited.
That's Arizona, by the way. That's how they're...
Yeah.
Yes.
I also recognize that in Utah, and I'm familiar with Arizona too, but in Utah, the attorneys general for the last 10 years, 15 years have said that the policy of the state is not to prosecute polygamy. My question is this. What does that vacuum over the last 60 years, since 1953, done to people who believe in the principle in terms of the insecurity, the vacuum that's been created between those two very different polarizations? And because I think that part of the problem is that when there's a vacuum like that, secondary crimes can arise. And we've seen that in the FLDS in spades. But it also has to do with the management that you mentioned. And I understand the libertarian argument that leave government out of everything, but the children in the FLDS community have no protections.
They do. There's laws against abandonment.
But the town is run by cops that are run by the FLDS church.
But
so
that's not a plural marriage issue.
It's not a plural marriage issue, and I understand the Canadian opinion. I've read it twice, if you can believe it. And I think it may well be skewed because of the FLDS, because I understand there's a world of difference. But there are some serious problems, and it's a very compelling opinion. And my question is, how do those problems get resolved when a state gives you these inconsistencies, forever prohibited, never prosecuted?
I know they have better answers than me, but I just wanted to say that when the Attorney General talked to me about it in the state of Utah, and he said, we do not prosecute polygamists for living polygamy, and he told me why. He said, because we don't have room in our prisons to hold them. And so I asked him, what if you did have room in your prisons? And he didn't have an answer. And that scared me. Because he has enough room in his prison for me.
Right, and now we have a new attorney general. And so every time that changes, that was what we told at the time Attorney General Shurtleff, when he said that to our community. One of the gentlemen stood up and said, sir, it's like you're holding a baseball bat, and I can see it. You've got it here, and you're saying, I'm not going to hit you. Come closer. Trust us. And that's really how it's felt. You know, we've been in a CPAC organization for a good number of years now. We've tried to break down our own barriers of prejudice, because they exist. And we've tried to come forward, be open, do some communicating and educating. And one of the things that always comes back to me is this is a threat, and don't get too friendly. They will, if the opportunity arises. So I just think that it's constantly the elephant in the room, the whatever on the shoulder, all the little cliches you can think of. Did you want to? Okay.
Are there any other questions? All right. I would like to thank all of our panelists. It's been very enlightening. You've had lots of good answers for us. And I hope everybody enjoys the evening.
Thank you for your patience.